This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
We're going to talk about the prospect of the communists taking power again. Harmeet Dhillon is here. What's going on at the DOJ? John Solomon. More breaking news. Kevin Robbins. All that and more coming up on I'm Right. We had a fundraiser once, back when I was running for Congress. And this fundraiser, when I was running for Congress, it was a shooting fundraiser. Seemed like a good idea. I was a Marine. People wanted to shoot guns with me. Hey, charge $5. I don't remember what it was. Come out, shoot guns with Jesse Kelly, that kind of thing. So we did this fundraiser. A bunch of people showed up. It was a good time for the most part. But this guy shows up. I'm not saying anything against him, but he clearly had never even held a gun in his hands before. That's fine. Everyone has their own levels of expertise. Sat him down, gave him all the safety briefings about things. Goes out there with his gun. We're all standing behind him. He's standing in front of the firing line. And he gets his gun, and it jams on him. Of course, I'm sure he'd never cleaned it in his life or whatnot. So he's got it pointed just like this, held to the side, just like this. And he turns around and points it at all of us. It's not working, pointing it at everybody. Horrifying. Everyone jumps on him. We put it down. Nobody was hurt. Then, half hour later, everyone had gone through taking their turn. This guy was up again. And we all had a good time after we got him calmed down, but this guy, it was his turn to shoot again. And when he was almost up, you could see it. You could feel the tension in the place. Everyone all of a sudden remembered, oh my gosh, we have somebody here who's going to kill somebody. Very, very dangerous. I think we forget that Democrats are extremely evil now and that Democrats intend to do great evil when they take power again. Because they're not in the White House, because they don't control the Senate, because they don't control the House, it feels like this. Oh, I'm glad he's off the shooting range now. Whew. We can just go back to, let's just try to be normal. We'll try to get this passed, get this done. But it feels like we can just take a breath now. They're going to take power again. And how we act now determines how fast they take power again and what exactly they're going to be able to do when they take power again. Some things they want to do, they're being quite obvious about it.
If Democrats win the House and possibly the Senate in November, there's a better than even chance Donald Trump gets impeached again.
Absolutely. He should be impeached now. I mean, he's taken us into a disastrous war, threatening war crimes in Iran. In terms of knocking out people, plants and knocking out electricity. And the Democrats will impeach him once we take back the House and should impeach him for all the things he's done.
Impeach Donald John Trump. For me, that's for me. I don't speak for anybody else. But I'm going to bring articles of impeachment against him. I promise you.
There's a reality here about whether or not an impeachment vote will actually get called. But on principle, do I think Donald Trump should be impeached? Absolutely.
There is nobody that wants to impeach Donald Trump more than me.
Impeachment. Okay, that's bad. See what Tulsi Gabbard just did? She just declassified documents showing the intelligence community worked alongside people like Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi, to set up and destroy Donald Trump. Do you understand what it means that the spy agencies of the country chose to not only start operating domestically, they operated domestically on behalf of the Democrat Party, and they operated on behalf of the Democrat Party to destroy the Republican Party. That's what they did last time. Remember how often we heard on the news that the walls were closing in?
the call for impeachment.
Rumblings of the word impeachment.
Breaking news.
Another bombshell out of the White House.
I believe this is the beginning of the end.
I do too.
It's really the beginning of the end.
The beginning of the end.
He may be feeling the walls closing in on him.
All the walls closing in on him.
The walls closing in.
The beginning of the end.
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 In fact, if this were a football game, we're in the third quarter. May even be the beginning of the end.
I do not think the president will serve out his term.
Resignation.
Resignation.
I don't think this president is going to serve out his term.
Mr. Trump will not serve out his term.
He will not serve out his term.
No way, no how.
Trump is in big trouble.
Trump's in a lot of trouble.
It's a sign of a terrified old man who feels the walls closing in.
The walls
are increasingly
closing in on him.
Tonight, the walls
are closing in.
Today changed everything. This is the beginning of the end.
Today, the biggest
tipping point for the Trump administration.
What a historic day. The bombshells, they fell.
It's entropy and it's crumbling internally.
He's underwater. He feels
the walls closing in.
Could his testimony be a turning point?
We may be at a tipping point.
It's the beginning of
the end.
The beginning
of the end.
Another bombshell.
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 This is a bombshell.
It is a bombshell.
I am beginning to resent the word bombshell.
Get ready for more of that if they take back the House in 2028. Now let me ask you something. It's almost a rhetorical question at this point because I've asked you that before, but not even talking about members of Congress or any of those clowns in the media we just saw. Do you know any Democrats in your life? Any? Do you know even one? Sister, co-worker, somebody? Everyone knows someone. All right. The Democrat in your life, have they ever, one time, said something along the lines of, we arrested Donald Trump multiple times, used the Department of Justice to arrest our political opponents, we convicted the Republican nominee of a bunch of felonies. That probably wasn't right. That wasn't the right thing to do. Have you ever heard, ever, one time, anywhere, in any situation, one Democrat express that sentiment? One time. You haven't. And the reason I know you haven't is I've been asking this question over and over and over and over and over again. I have to just send me one email. One. Never. We get thousands of emails a day. Never. One. Because that Democrat doesn't exist. The truth is Democrats are communists. Communists believe in using political power to smash their political opponents. For them, that's really the only thing power is to be used for. And the only lesson Democrats in this country learned from last time is they didn't get to go far enough. If they lost an election, they lost the House, they lost the Senate, they lost the presidency. Well, it wasn't because they're sick, evil, turned everything gay. No, none of that at all. Opened the border, caused inflation. Yeah, that never occurred to them. The only thing that occurred to any of them is we didn't hurt our political opponents enough. Next time, we will. Here they are saying it.
What does a Project 2029 agenda look like for you?
I don't think you can speak of it in shorthand, but I'll just say a couple of things that I think are absolutely necessary. One is we've got to restore the rule of law, and that means holding people accountable who've broken the law. I'm talking about in this administration, when we get a new one, the people in this administration who've broken the law. And federal agents who've broken the law need to be held accountable.
And that means criminally prosecuted.
Criminally prosecuted, civilly prosecuted, you know, whatever it is that we can do.
So to be clear, the next president, whether it's President Newsom or someone else you think needs to elevate the debate, but also ensure accountability, legal accountability for anyone who broke the law.
Yeah, it's behest. Yeah, I think you have to knit that back and you have to do both because you by definition are doing both. It's not weaponizing grievance. It's not pursuing retribution in the spirit that defines Trump and Trumpism. It's not about vengeance in that respect. It's not that. It's simply about accountability, that the chips fall where they may.
They're going to do worse next time. Let's look back, shall we, on what they did last time. One of the most nakedly evil things the United States government has ever done. Roe versus Wade was overturned. All right. The pro-abortion people were super mad about it. Okay, so what did they do? Well, they dug up an old law, obscure, no one really cared about it, no one enforced it, called the FACE Act. They, out of a hissy fit, took a hissy fit about Roe versus Wade being overturned and dug up an obscure law and started throwing pro-lifers in prison? You know, these dangerous criminals? That's what they did last time. The attorney general at the time was asked, hey, you're using the FACE Act to throw a bunch of pastors in prison for singing worship songs. Why aren't you throwing any of the communists in prison for firebombing pro-life clinics? And here's what the top law enforcement officer in the country, a communist, said.
I will say you're quite right. There are many more prosecutions with respect to the blocking of the of the abortion centers, but that is generally because they are those actions are taken in with photography at the time during the daylight, and seeing the person who did it is quite easy. Those who are attacking the pregnancy resources centers, which is a horrid thing to do, are doing this at night in the dark.
Sorry, it's nighttime. It's too dark. That's what they did last time. And the only lesson they learned from last time was they didn't do enough. Let's not forget about what's going to happen if we allow these people to take power again. It's kind of everything. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. We'll talk to John Solomon about some of these stories in a moment. Before we talk to John, let me talk to you about American businesses. Aren't you so sick of the hiring of foreigners? Over and over and over again, you deal with an American business, and all you deal with is foreigners. Can't ever hear somebody who speaks English. They never understand you. They don't care. They're clearly just reading off a checklist, trying to get you off the phone so they can go back demon worshiping or whatever it is that they do. And then you get a hold of Pure Talk, and you get to talk to an American who speaks English, and they're pleasant. They're not reading off the screen. Well, I've been taught by my No more of that. Just, hey, how can I help? 10 minutes on the phone. You don't need Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile. Go to puretalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Well, in the interest of looking forward to see what we may be in store for if these people take power again, maybe we should rewind and get some more detail on what exactly the deep state did last time. Let's look back on one of those Trump impeachments, shall we? Let's ask John about it. Joining me now, John Solomon, founder of the wonderful Just the News. Before we get to the new data dump, this will, of course, lead us to the new data dump. John, why don't you remind us of the nitty-gritty, dirty details of what they did last time these people held power?
Well, they had a wash, rinse, and repeat cycle of always trying to hang a fake scandal on Donald Trump. So, and each time they did it, Jesse, it was to neutralize a problem that a Democrat had. In 2015-16, Hillary Clinton had a Russia problem. Her husband had taken a lot of money for a speech. She had made lots of concessions at the State Department to Vladimir Putin. They got played. So they hanged the fake Russia collusion story on Donald Trump. In spring of 2019, right after Donald Trump's been cleared by Robert Mueller for Russia collusion, he didn't engage in it. I break the stories about Hunter Biden and Joe Biden firing the prosecutor who was investigating Hunter Biden's Ukraine company, and immediately they start an impeachment. In 2021, they discover that Joe Biden has classified documents by his Corvette in his garage and at his old office at UPenn, and they go start a Mar-a-Lago raid against Donald Trump. And then in 23, when Joe Biden is showing clear signs of mental acuity, they come up with the Arctic Frost investigation and the notion that they're going to charge Donald Trump years after January 6th with some sort of conspiracy to stop the election from being certified. It's a common theme, the same type of players, the same type of tactics, the same type of illusion. Make something look what it's not, fake the American people. When they eventually find out it's not true, the political damage will already be occurred. And that's what we're in for, again, if Democrats are already promising it if they win the November election. So get ready if that election goes the Democrats' way.
What did we learn with this Tulsi Gabbard data dump she dumped on us? Anything actually new? I mean, you've been all over this stuff for so long, but what did we learn? What's the new stuff we learned?
Well, first, a big bravo to Tulsi Gabbard. I asked her to declassify these documents. She went through great effort to do so. There was a lot of resistance in the intelligence community to not declassify them. She stood up to it, and she did it. So bravo. What do we know? We know now that the American public, the senators sitting in judgment of President Trump during the 2019 impeachment, the House managers who were prosecuting him, and the lawyers who were defending him, people like Alan Dershowitz, were kept in the dark about significant derogatory information about President Trump's chief accuser on Ukraine. It was a CIA analyst. He said that he believed that Donald Trump had hijacked a call with the new Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, to try to pressure the Ukraine president to investigate Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's corrupt dealings in Ukraine. The accuser didn't believe there was anything corrupt about what Hunter and Joe Biden did. He thought what went on was extortion on the call. Well, what we learned in these documents, what we were kept from in 2019, it could have changed the entire course of impeachment, was that, one, the accuser was incredibly biased. He worked for Joe Biden. He was a registered Democrat. He disliked Donald Trump and the people around Donald Trump. He so disliked the people around Donald Trump, he specifically requested that Devin Nunes, then one of the Gang of Eight in the House of Representatives, someone entitled to get this intelligence, would be kept from the information about the accuser. That's not a normal whistleblower. That is someone with a political agenda. Two, that when he submitted his whistleblower complaint, he had lied. He had given a falsehood. He denied talking to Congress when, in fact, he had been talking to Adam Schiff's investigators before he blew the whistle, and I put blew the whistle in air marks at this point. And three, he knew nothing firsthand. Everything he knew was hearsay, and as the investigative community began looking at it, they determined some of the things that he assumed were not right. And more importantly, some of the people that came to support him and say, I like this guy, you should trust him, they themselves said they didn't trust his account of what happened. One of them said, I would have not have, this is a friend of the alleged whistleblower, I wouldn't have connected the dots he connected. So these are issues that go directly to his credibility, to his reliability, to his biases. In any court of law, they were to be considered Brady material, had to be turned over by the government. But Adam Schiff, the chief prosecutor, Michael Atkinson, the Intelligence Committee Inspector General who took this whistleblower complaint, they kept this information classified so that Donald Trump wouldn't know about it. He couldn't have a fair trial, couldn't have a fair impeachment. The evidence is so shocking that one of President Trump's impeachment lawyers, Alan Dershowitz, who back in 2019 was still a Democrat, said that I believe there is grounds for Donald Trump to go to the Chief Justice of the United States, who is the trial judge, John Roberts, or go to Congress and say, you should vacate or expunge the impeachment because it was obtained under false pretenses. That's how serious this stuff is.
So, not to oversimplify this, John, and please correct me if I miss any of this. So, a registered Democrat who worked for Joe Biden, happened to be an employee of the CIA, wasn't even firsthand on the call, basically made up things about the call after being coached, allegedly, possibly, by Adam Schiff, and all that was used to impeach the President of the United States of America. Did I miss anything?
Yeah, it's pretty close, dude. I mean, whether he made it up or whether some people told it to him firsthand or secondhand, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, he wasn't in a firsthand position. There is a line in his whistleblower complaint. And if it had come out in 2019, I don't think we would have got to impeachment. It said, I had no firsthand knowledge of what the president said and did. Think about that. He's making an accusation about the president, and he doesn't know anything that the president has said and done. That would have been a killer moment in the impeachment. It probably would have stopped the impeachment in its tracks, along with the fact that he worked for Joe Biden specifically on Ukraine. That's exactly right. We were given a show and a dance, and there was no script behind it that was accurate.
John, from a 30,000-foot view, if I'm just looking at all these scandals, it's wild how often Ukraine seems to pop up in that little bubble sketch. Why is that?
Ukraine, for a long time, was the piggy bank of the Democratic Party. There were these oligarchs who were large donors to Hillary Clinton's foundation. They were big supporters of Democratic and liberal movements. Some didn't live in Ukraine but cared about Ukraine, like George Soros. Some were actual oligarchs that operated in Ukraine. And the Democratic Party gave great deference to Ukraine. And when it needed to neutralize its own scandals, meaning Hillary Clinton had a Russia scandal or Hunter Biden, Joe Biden had a Ukraine scandal, these oligarchs, these players in Ukraine could come and help create the illusion that Donald Trump or his team had done something wrong when, in fact, it was the other way around. It was Hillary Clinton doing something wrong with Russia. It was Joe Biden and Hunter Biden running a grift in Ukraine while he was vice president. So Ukraine has been a piggy bank for the Democratic Party for a long time. That dynamic's changing. I think the Ukrainian people are more loyal now to President Trump and grateful for the assertive action he's taken to help Ukraine level the war in Russia, try to get to a peace deal. And the Democratic Party may have burned a lot of alliances in Ukraine because they weren't willing to do the hard decisions that Donald Trump has to level out that war and give Ukraine a fighting chance against Russia.
John, keep going, sir. Can't wait to have you back. Talk soon. Talk to Harmeet Dhillon about what's going on at the DOJ. Before we do that, let me talk to you about... Well, I just got my blood work back, as a matter of fact. I have an official meeting with the doctor tomorrow about my blood work, but you should know testosterone levels were through the roof. 44 years old. Shouldn't those things be tailing off by now? No. I feel great. Why? Because I take a natural herbal supplement stack from Chalk. Specifically, I take a male vitality stack every single day. My blood work reflects it. My energy, my focus, my mind works well. I want you to feel how I feel. They have female vitality stacks and male vitality stacks, the best natural herbal supplements on the planet. Go to chalk.com/JesseTV and get a subscription today. We'll be back. Well, I'm terribly biased. I've admitted that to you many times before. When it comes to pro-life issues, I'm terribly biased. But what the Biden administration, specifically the Biden DOJ, did with the FACE Act to pro-lifers is one of the most profoundly evils ever done by the United States government in the history of this country. It's the kind of thing we mock countries like Russia, China for. Look at their government, tin pot dictators. That's exactly what we did here. It was a deep, deep evil. And I hope we can do something to make it right. Joining me now, one of the truly great people in the Trump administration. You know I'm a fan, Harmeet Dhillon, U.S. Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Harmeet, specifically, what did these monsters do to pastors praying outside of abortion clinics?
Well, Jesse, I share your love for the pro-life movement and have been a longtime lawyer in that regard. At the Department of Justice, our job is to apply our laws objectively, and that's not what happened here with the FACE Act. And I'm charged in my department with enforcing the FACE Act. So there's two things. First of all, they never used the FACE Act in the way that it was also intended, which is to protect houses of worship. But when it came to reproductive centers, they aggressively weaponized the FACE Act to go after people protesting, praying even, just silently praying outside abortion clinics, and they sought harsher sentences for people convicted of the FACE Act if they were protesting abortion clinics versus the handful of cases where they went after people as a token, I believe, who were praying or who were trying to obstruct the pro-life crisis pregnancy centers. And so because of that dichotomy, that's clearly not applying the law objectively. They also met regularly with pro-abortion groups and worked with them to track the activities of pro-life protesters, pro-life people of faith who are praying, and, you know, kind of just preemptively focus on them. And there was a group of lawyers here in the Civil Rights Division in the criminal section who made it their life's work to persecute pro-life objectors outside abortion clinics. And one of these lawyers in my former lawyers in my department even worked with one of these pro-abortion groups to get a grant to that group. And so, you know, you see just in the emails that have been produced in this report, it's an over 800-page report produced by Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche today. It is just staggering the amount of bias that we saw here. Now, three of those lawyers left voluntarily, and one was terminated by the Department of Justice this week. And, you know, what I can say is that as a result of the miscarriages of justice that occurred in these prosecutions, the president pardoned a number of pro-life protesters who were convicted of praying outside these abortion clinics, and the United States has had to pay some damages to some of these people as well.
They sure earned it. Harmeet, can you speak for just a moment about the token cases? Because this is one of those things that will inevitably come up when you bring this up to some dirty communists. They'll say, well, they were going after people on the other side too, but they knew what they were doing, didn't they? What did they do?
Well, Jesse, I'm aware of approximately 200 attacks on pro-life crisis pregnancy centers in the United States over the last few years. And I'm aware of the Biden administration going after one of those incidents. And there was a case of Jane's Revenge, a group that after the Dobbs opinion came out, started harassing and targeting three different crisis pregnancy centers in Florida and terrorizing them. And there was a conviction. What, three people pled guilty, I believe misdemeanors, and there was a misdemeanor conviction in that case. Again, as I mentioned, the DOJ sought much lighter sentences in those cases than they did against protesters outside abortion clinics. And so when those pardons came down, they didn't include this one case that I just mentioned. And I've gone to court to the 11th Circuit to defend that prosecution. And we won that defense. And so in that case, this person who went to trial and tried her case, she was convicted of a Klan Act offense of conspiring to interfere. But there are hundreds of these cases, and the DOJ cherry-picked one. So it's been a charge that I've given to my groups as in my lawyers, my prosecutors, is if we could find other examples of witnesses willing to come forward within the statute of limitations to protect these crisis pregnancy centers that provide, often for no charge, ultrasound and other very useful and important services to pregnant women, then we should do that. And so, and by the way, if there are egregious situations of people blockading other types of pregnancy centers, including abortion clinics, we'll continue to enforce the law, but we're not going to do it against people praying and not interfering with access to those abortion clinics. That's simply not in the interest of justice and not what the statute intended.
Harmeet, can you speak for a moment about this part of it? Because, you know, I find a cockroach in my house. That's not actually the frightening thing. A cockroach is not hard. You just stamp it out and throw it in the garbage before your wife sees it. The scary thing is that means you have more. You say, yeah, we had four of these people. We had to let them go. I know you were on it as much as you can be. How many of these snakes do we still think are worming their way through the DOJ?
Well, I think there's zero at this point. And I think it's been pretty widely reported in the press that when I came on board a little bit over a year ago, it's my 1 year anniversary this week, this last week, actually. In my second week, I put out my agenda, which was basically the president's agenda through the lens of the civil rights laws that we enforce here. And that caused, according to publicly reported numbers, about 75% of the lawyers here at the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division to quit. The criminal section became very small. And, you know, you can see who worked on these cases. Their names are on the briefs for the last many years. And the last one left the building this week. So we have staffed up since that time, and we've hired people who are willing to work consistent with our current law enforcement priorities. And, you know, we're hiring on a nonpartisan basis, of course, but we are looking for more people to join our team so that we can fully go after cases for all Americans, not just for the favored few.
Abigail Spanberger is trying to ban semi-automatic firearms in the great state of Virginia, where there are lots of those firearms. Harmeet, this is one of those things where people look and they think, they can't do that, right? Can they?
Well, they have been doing that in various states. I agree with the premise that they can't do that, and I've actually gone to court to argue that myself in the Seventh Circuit, arguing against Illinois' version of the same type of bill that we're discussing here. Rhode Island's Senate has a bill before it as well that also purports to ban semi-automatic rifles, including the AR-15, the most popular rifle in the United States, widely in use. And under the Supreme Court's precedents, particularly the Bruin precedent, when you look at the historical analysis, and Justice Thomas lays this out very clearly, it is clear that semi-automatic rifles of the nature of the AR-15 are protected by the Constitution and by the Second Amendment. And so I did warn Governor Spanberger that if she signed that bill, that we will immediately file suit. And so far, she hasn't signed it. Yesterday was her deadline to sign it. She instead sent it back to the legislature with some minor technical edits that don't cure the problems that I identified in my letter. Now, she has signed some other laws into effect. There's a so-called ghost gun bill about home-manufactured firearms or firearms parts, and that's going to be analyzed under our ATF regulations and other issues. We're going to look at those laws. And there's also a law that is very concerning that effectively removes immunity from gun manufacturers and tries to hold them liable for all the crimes that occur or injuries that are inflicted with their firearms, which is a really ridiculous law that's designed to put gun manufacturing out of business in our country. And I think it's inconsistent with federal law, because the right to carry, the right to bear arms, the right to have them in your home and enjoy them for lawful purposes is meaningless if you're not able to acquire those firearms. Similarly, Virginia is considering laws that require gun owners to render many of their firearms inoperable. Again, that it is meaningless to be able to own a firearm if you're not able to use it to hunt, to defend yourself, or other lawful purposes. And so this DOJ has been incredibly aggressive on this issue. We filed multiple lawsuits all over the country. I have a new Second Amendment section in my department, and lawyers are joining it on a regular basis to help us go after these laws. And so for every law I challenge, I get inundated by folks in the gun rights community suggesting that I do a bunch of other things. We would love to. So if anyone here is watching, is a lawyer, and is interested in helping us, please apply at usajobs.gov. We are hiring to expand this work at the DOJ Civil Rights Division.
usajobs.gov. The lady needs some help. Harmeet, thank you so much. I appreciate it. All right. Talk to Kevin Roberts next. You want to know one of the main reasons the party in power loses seats in the midterm election almost every single time? It's not just because they screw something up. It's a matter of motivation. The truth is that communists in this country will crawl across broken glass to go vote against Republicans right now, and Republicans aren't as motivated, which brings me to things like the Dignidad Act. It's not just that the law is freaking horrible, it's that it disenfranchises Republican voters even more. They may not vote Democrat, but they sit at home. Our losses get worse. The communists get more power. You see the problem with this kind of thing? Joining me now, Dr. Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation. Kevin, I am concerned because I don't hear Republican leadership at any level shooting this law down. It's still out there. They're on a press tour trying to pass it. And even if it doesn't pass, every day it's out there with Maria Salazar running her fat mouth about it, we lose more votes in the midterms.
Well, I wish in this case, my friend, I could disagree with you. But in fact, your pretty pessimistic diagnosis is spot on, as it always is. And there are three elements to this. The first is DC as usual, which ought to scare the daylights out of us, considering that conservatives have the trifecta in Washington, DC. The second, as you point out, Jesse, is the substance of this bill, ridiculously named the Dignidad Act. I say ridiculous not because I dislike the Spanish language, but a proposed American law ought to be in English, just as English ought to be the official language of this country. The substance of it is awful. But the third thing that I'll introduce into this conversation, at the risk of making you even more pessimistic today, is that we have the Senate Republicans, which is to say squishy Republicans, driving reconciliation. Why is that? How is that connected to Dignidad? Because this is typical Washington, D.C. business as usual. What's going to happen if conservatives, if Republicans in power in the House and Senate continue to allow both the conversation about the Dignidad Act, but also continue to push this so-called skinny reconciliation, is that conservative voters, to your point about the typical outcome of midterms, will sit on their hands and not vote in the fall. And you know what? I just have to say, I can't blame them. Heritage, as you know, to sum up here, advises policymakers with policies that are viewed through the lens of the everyday American. And everyday Americans are really fed up with business as usual. They were expecting more of it to change by now in Washington.
Why hasn't it changed much? Or I know there have been changes, and there have been positive changes. I'm not trying to doom and gloom the whole thing. I understand that. Is it just that the ship takes so long to turn? But sometimes it seems like we're not turning it. I'm a little frustrated.
I share your frustration, and my point is this. Number one, I agree with you that there are some significant achievements that have happened, but almost all of them have come from the executive branch. They've all come from the innovation of President Trump and his cabinet and advisors. And it isn't as if Congress has done nothing. The one big, beautiful bill is very important. Our point at Heritage is this. We can acknowledge all of those things. We celebrate those things. To some extent, maybe we played a tiny role on the outside helping our friends get them done. It's that we're looking at the midterm elections and what has Congress done since July 4th, 2025, when the president signed the one big beautiful bill. They've talked a lot, they've done some things, but nothing that's turned into legislation that can actually generate voter turnout. That's the precise reason for our frustration. And so we believe, in addition to needing to kill this ridiculously named Dignidad Act, that Congress needs to expand the scope of this so-called skinny reconciliation. And I want to be really clear. I hate using DC inside the bubble terminology like skinny reconciliation, because I look at this through the lens of a common sense person, and that is the conservative Congress, albeit with a narrow mathematical majority, can force a party line vote that not only funds ICE and Customs and Border Patrol, but could do things like introduce conservative healthcare reform, more permitting reform, deregulation on the energy industry, which everyone would benefit from given spikes in oil and gas prices because of what's going on in Iran. The point is, there's an opportunity for Congress to deliver on Trump's agenda, to codify it, to turn it into law. And that's the kind of thing that would allow conservative voters come this fall to say, I want to continue to make sure that these good guys are in power next year.
Talk to me about the economy, because I'm blown away by how many of my emails are people speaking of disenfranchised. They're just not making it. And, you know, you'll turn on the news every now and then and you'll hear, well, great jobs report, this looks good and that looks good and all that stuff's fine. I'm not dismissive of it. But I have so many people who are not making it. They do not feel economic relief and they're angry. They thought they were going to get economic relief after November.
Yeah, there are two sides to this coin, and what you said is absolutely correct. And so that side of the coin, which is, you know, what economists would say is the micro level, is that we just haven't yet seen on the sidewalk level of everyday life the tremendous benefits that I think are on the way as a result of some of the Trump reforms, some of the reforms from the aforementioned one big beautiful bill. And the problem is that even though, for example, you take some prices like the price of milk, the price of eggs, the price of beef, all of which have come down from the historic highs under the Biden administration, the average voter, even the average voter who is very fond of President Trump and conservative, says they haven't come down enough. And they're being aggravated, obviously, by the dramatic increase in oil and gas prices over the last 5 or 6 weeks because of the Iran conflict. The other side of the coin, which is to give credit where it's due, is that President Trump, Treasury Secretary Bessent, have initiated some very significant beneficial reforms that are, in fact, going to be seen by everyday Americans. The question, Jesse, is this. Will they see those in time so that they affect their votes in a good way for the midterms? And again, I've come back to the midterms, not because I think that elections are the end-all, be-all, but because I believe that if the left comes into power next year, we will have zero chance of initiating, obviously, any good reforms. And I want the Americans you're talking about who are aligned with the president but frustrated with the economic realities they're seeing right now, which is that they simply can't make ends meet, to have some substantive hope rather than just D.C. speak that eventually Congress is going to get to it.
It's the SAVE Act dead and gone. Look, I never gave it a chance to pass anyway, so... But it is what it is. But is it done?
When we started working on it many months ago, we were told that there was about a 5% chance. And so my response was, you're telling me there's a chance. And I still believe that that's the case. I still believe that's the case. Our great friend, Senator Mike Lee, our friend, Congressman Chip Roy, have been stalwarts on this. Look, we also read reality truthfully at Heritage. I think the chances are small, but ultimately, if we don't continue this push, we on the outside, you and me and your audience, along with our friends on the inside, then what's going to happen is that people inside Congress will say, let's put the SAVE Act in reconciliation. And there are two reasons that's unlikely to work. The first is it has to get through the dumb parliamentarians' ruling. And the second is, even if it does, the mechanism of the Save America Act would be an optional grant that only red states would participate in. So the reason we're continuing to fight for it, which includes the talking filibuster as it's been named, is not because there's a 75% chance, but because it's the righteous thing to do, and the chances remain greater than zero.
Can we bounce back for the midterms, Kevin? That's all I want to know. Can we, if we get things right, the messaging right, do we have time? Because I really don't want these people to take power again. Can we do this?
Yes, you have to account for our unbridled optimism at Heritage, but there's some substance behind this. So let me lay out, if I may, the sequence of what needs to happen. The Iran conflict needs to come to an end. We happen to think at Heritage the president could declare war declare victory today, and it would be successful. God bless him for prosecuting this war as well as he has. But the tolerance of the American people for the attention on that, as opposed to the economy, as we were discussing, probably will only last another few weeks. It's just a political reality, in spite of how well the president has done in prosecuting the war. Let's say we get to May. Iran is in the rearview mirror. It'll be several weeks before oil and gas prices come down, but they will. You will also see, as my economist colleague, Dr. E.J. Antoni, has been predicting, that by the end of the second quarter, so the middle of the summer, you ought to start seeing some of the benefits of the One Big Beautiful Bill. If we have that, if we have the Save America Act, for example, then the conservative base will really be motivated to turn out in the fall. There's one other factor to introduce here, and that is the insanity of the left. I live in Virginia, and I can tell you that this increasingly Soviet state led by Abigail Spanberger is reminding people of what the left does when they're in power. And so I think if you put those things together, and very importantly, you use the opportunity, if you're Congress, to pass not a skinny reconciliation, but a broad, ambitious vision of what you will do in the future if you're returned to power, what we at Heritage are calling the American Opportunity Agenda, we think that you actually pick up seats in both the House and the Senate. But do you know what that requires, my friend? Political courage.
Courage.
And I can tell you that that is not in high supply inside the halls of Congress. It's why people like you, everyone in your audience, and we at Heritage do what we do. I'm here to tell you, keep fighting. It is not lost. There's plenty of time to turn this around, but the clock is ticking.
Thank you, my friend. Please keep going. Appreciate you guys. Lighten the mood. Next. All right, it's time to lighten the mood. And we all know that Eric Swalwell was kind of done with politics. He was in Congress, pretty safe seat. And then he decided he wanted to be the governor of California. I don't know, maybe Icarus flew a little too close to the sun, because now he's not going to be governor of California. And he just resigned from Congress. And the truth is, Eric Swalwell clearly can't keep his hands to himself. I don't know if there were crimes committed. Certainly sounds like there are plenty of criminal accusations out there. There are a bunch of lessons to be learned here. One of the main lessons is that Eric Swalwell is a gigantic dork goober, and you don't hand power to gigantic dork goobers because then they can't handle it. It's like giving a crackhead $100 million. It's just gonna go poorly. You're better off just letting them go the way they are. So Eric Swalwell's gone. But let's not forget the funniest thing he ever did, and that's fart on live television.
The evidence is uncontradicted that the president used taxpayer dollars to ask the Ukrainians to help him cheat an election. And the complaint that I've heard from... The evidence is uncontradicted that the president used taxpayer dollars to ask the Ukrainians to help him cheat an election. Ask the Ukrainians to help him cheat an election.
I'll see you tomorrow.